Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
Innate construction software transforms the way owners, contractors, and engineers manage projects and programs. With Innate, you get an integrated project controls platform that solves challenges in every phase of the capital project lifecycle. These are field-tested solutions that give stakeholders the information they need to minimize risk, improve operational efficiency, and control project costs. Innate, transforming the way the world builds. Learn more at innate.com. That's INEIGHT.com. Project Chatter is sponsored by JustDo.com. JustDo.com is a cutting-edge next-gen project management portfolio platform which doesn't force you into a project structure or hierarchy. Think of it as the Minecraft of project management systems with integrated task-based chat, Gantt, Kanban, and much more. It's the only 21st century real-time platform available today. In this episode, we speak to Colin D. Ellis. He is back on the Project Chatter podcast and live with us in London. Colin D. Ellis is an award-winning international speaker, four-time best-selling author, and much sought-after workplace culture and project management expert who works with organizations around the world to help them transform the way they get things done. He's originally from Liverpool in the UK, but now lives with his family in Melbourne, Australia. And you can find more about Colin on www.colindellis.com. We'll post a link in the show notes. But Martin, we didn't have Val for this one because this was a special episode. We were in person with Colin. He's got a trip over here to the UK. So Val, you missed out. But what an amazing treat to have an in-person podcast.
It was brilliant, yeah. And having all of us in a room at the same time, it was brilliant. And having someone of his experience and know-how and years of experience was fantastic. We learned so much. I think I took about four pages of notes, even though he sat next to me at the time. It was fantastic, yeah.
And that's four pages of notes. But no, it was a special treat. I mean, we opened up. I think we're going to title this episode Culture, Whiskey and Wine, WHINE, as in whining or whinging about a few things that are wrong with project management cultures and organizational cultures. But what are some of the highlights that you took down in the four pages?
And the four pages, yeah, it's just racking my brains now. I really like the bit where he was saying to take time to build a culture at the start of the project. You know, we've probably all sat in meetings, in workshops where we do the same old things, same old team building. And it's about getting that culture right at the start of the project, and the way he kind of illustrated that and really demonstrated it was brilliant. And how anyone can choose to be a leader, I really like that bit. There's a particular phrase, more wind farms, that comes through loud and clear during the pod, and that was my favorite. But how about yourself?
I did like that analogy as well, you know, the oil tanker versus the wind farm. But I think I actually really enjoyed the way he just peeled back the layers on the various topics we threw at him. Courage as well. He really peeled back the layers on what it means to be courageous. And this isn't a podcast for leaders necessarily. It's a podcast for everyone, this episode. So I think let's leave it there. Let's not spoil too much for the listeners. But folks, as we say, keep listening, keep liking, and keep paying it forward. Hello, project people, and welcome back to a brand new episode of the Project Chatter podcast. This is a very, very special episode. We don't have Val with us today because he's in Australia, unfortunately. But we're all based in London in the same room, which is amazing. So thank you, Martin, for putting up with us. But how are you, Martin, first and foremost?
Very good, thanks. And yourselves?
Yeah, very good. All the better for having Mr. Colin D. Ellis back with us. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Dale. Thank you. It's great to be here. We're not going to do any kind of awkward intro. You're going to dub that in afterwards.
We'll dub that in afterwards.
I'll write something suitably but great.
What I would like to know, though, is since we last spoke to you, what have you been up to?
Well, the question I often get asked now, because obviously last time we spoke, COVID and everything like that, people are like, oh, it was a really struggle. Nothing shines a light on a broken culture or a broken project than a crisis. And so I found that, you know, and I made that shift pretty quickly. I recognized that we still needed to build teams, and we still do, you know, in these hybrid environments. And so I created a virtual program where I would help projects and programs to develop their cultures, or teams to build cultures to make sure that they stay connected. So it has been pretty full on for the last couple of years. And I've been mainly in my basement talking to a small camera with a lot of people giving me thumbs up and waves and random stuff like that. But, you know, it's great to be traveling. I have to say it's great to be traveling again, and obviously being in the UK for the next couple of weeks, doing a bit of work, a few speeches, and being able to do stuff like this. Fabulous.
No, it's been absolutely awesome to meet you in person. As you say, we spoke together, I think, the first time during the pandemic. Mm. And, you know, it's been a real treat for us to meet our guest here in the UK, Martin.
Definitely.
But to have an international guest, I know you're originally from the UK, but for all intents and purposes, you're an international guest, and you now live in Australia. It's great to have you in the person. I think we landed on in the pub just before we started recording. I think we perhaps landed on a topic of for this podcast of culture, whiskey, and wine, but not the wine you drink. The wine is in W-H-I-N-E. So maybe we'll whine a little bit about how there's toxic cultures going on. Mm-hmm. Potentially, I know you don't like that word. You'll be having a play on it, I think.
Yeah.
But let's pick the middle word, whiskey.
Yeah.
What have we got here? Because you were starting to explain what you're tasting there, but I'd love for you to share with the listeners what we're drinking.
Yeah, typical me. I was jumping the gun, and you were like, "Stop talking about it. Wait till the podcast." That's how I remember it. So immediately, stop it.
I'm sure I wasn't that harsh, but anyway,
you probably said, "Oh, Colin, that'd be great for the podcast." I just don't remember it in that way. So we're drinking a Hakushu. Hakushu is a Suntory whiskey. And this is a Distiller's Reserve. These are great glasses, by the way, Martin. It says Beowulf on the whiskey glass. And so it's quite floral on the nose. I'm going to make it out that I drink whiskey all of the time, which is entirely true. It's quite floral on the nose. And it's really quite... It's kind of fruity, herby. Mm. I mean, we said in the pub, and you were like, oh, it's got notes of mint. Oh, I kind of get that now. I didn't when I first tasted it, but I did. It's quite herby, and it's very, very smooth. I think the thing that puts people off drinking whiskey is when they drink it, it's like, oh, it's really strong. And that's because they take too big a mouthful of it. You know, it's like, it's not beer and it's not wine. It's meant to be drunk delicately,
yes.
Which is beautiful. It's beautiful.
It's a lovely, lovely sip of whiskey. I mean, Martin probably has that trouble because we might go on a separate episode where he talks to us about his 650 odd beers he went through in the calendar year, because he certainly takes two big sips. I've been to a couple of whiskey conventions, if you can call it that, and yeah, he does overstep the mark at times. But thank you.
One big drink and he's done.
But Martin, it's a whiskey tasting event, you know. But no, thank you very much for that, and it's lovely to have you here and to share a whiskey with you.
Yeah.
So, moving on to, I guess there's culture and there's wine or whinging that we can get into, and then we can do both in equal measure. I think we did a little bit of it when we first sort of sat down at the pub just before. Some of the topics we discussed around is, you know, who's really driving change? Why isn't organizations changing as fast as we want them to? Why are they still asking really, I guess certainly for us when we exchange conversation, quite simple questions that they couldn't see the answers to. So we can get into that whole thing. I mean, I previously said on the podcast that we've got dinosaur leadership in some organizations. And I think the only way to eradicate that is to allow them to get extinct. But then there's also the empathetic side to say, well, actually, they have their window on the world and they only know what they know. And so maybe it's incumbent on us that know a different view on the world to educate them and help them. And you've certainly been doing that, on the road. That's why you're here in Europe at the moment. But where do you want to start with this? Because we can go anywhere. It's unscripted, as we were saying.
Well, let's start with that education piece there, because I think that's really important. Because I was talking to a PMO manager or a head of project management earlier today, and we were talking about exactly that and how leadership don't value project management. And in my experience, that's absolutely true. And I recorded a video on LinkedIn earlier, and I talked about project management and how is it as a profession we have so many accidental project managers, and you know, we don't have any accidental accountants. You know, if we're short in accounts, we're not like, oh, Dale, what are you doing? Would you mind being an accountant? And yet, for some reason, we have that in project management. It's like, oh, Martin, you don't have anything on. Here's a development opportunity for you. We want you to deliver HS2. We kind of don't have that sense of why it's so important, why we need that professionalism. Mm. And we have to educate. And the only way that we can educate leaders is not by implementing more process. It's by being passionate about what's important about delivering, you know. And I've talked in the past there about the fact that it doesn't matter what kind of project you're delivering. It's build a team, build a plan, deliver the project, always in that order. And yet there are so many senior leaders who take this Nike approach to project delivery, you know, just do it, just do it, just do it, just do it. And then they wonder why it never delivers on time, it never delivers on budget. Well, because we didn't do things properly.
Mm.
We didn't do things in the right way. And we need more people who understand project management to be passionate and to talk to leaders in a way that they understand. Is if you want the outcomes that you're looking for, we have to do things in the right way. Nobody ever rushes year end in finance, because finance say it's got to be done this way and it's going to take us this month and leave us alone to do it. And yet project managers, if senior leader says, oh, we just skip the plan and we just go, okay, we'll just do that then. And so we need more people to be passionate about project management and stand up for our profession. I don't want that to come across as a criticism, but I think for too long within project management, we just rolled over. And you know, I know there's at least a dozen people I know who are prepared to take a stand and say, you know what, no more. Let's educate these leaders on what it takes to be great at delivering, and let's make sure we stand behind it.
So what has actually changed in the last generation, say from the 30 years? It sounds like there's been some quite good progress in that field. You know, we were probably still talking about culture 30 years ago from the, you know, it's probably gone from the shouty PM out on site to the more empathetic leader. What, in your opinion, has changed, and where is it going to go in the next, what are we going to be talking about in 5 years' time?
Pace of change is slow. One of the things that we were talking about in the pub, I make it sound like we were in the pub for hours, but really we've only been there for about 4 days. But one of the things we were talking about, and Dale made a comment about turning the oil tank around. I'm like, no. I was like, that's the old, we don't want to, because what we do with turning the oil tank around is we're waiting for something that's old fashioned and almost obsolete, and we're watching it going, there it goes. Yeah, it's still turning. It's, whereas actually what we want is a wind farm in the sea. And we're like, oh, what's that? And I think what we've got is a generation of project people coming through now. There's still not as many. You know, one of the points that I make is no one's at university going, oh, I really want to be a project manager. I want to do something that's so critically important yet so undervalued. No one's doing that, right? But we need more wind farms in the sea, so we're not looking at the oil tankers anymore. And I think what's changed is we've got generationally, Martin, what we're seeing is people are demanding different things. And you know, the PMI did some research recently where they said they're going to need 3.5 million project managers every year in order to be able to deliver the amount of change that's required. And my question is, how? Because the workforce is aging, the project management as a profession is aging, and it's aging in its ideas, Martin. So what we need is people who are focused on, you know, and I've always talked about the fact that, you know, project management, leadership, culture, methods, and for too long, it's been predominantly methods. It's been Prince 2, it's been PMBOK, it's been Agile, and it's not that that's wrong. It's just that that's been the driving force. Where generationally now, people are like, I want to feel safe in my role. I want to create a team where people feel a sense of connection, where I feel a sense of belonging. I want to be a role model for other people. I want my purpose to connect to my project's purpose, to connect to the organization's purpose. where in the past we were so fixated on this command and control, if we follow the process, we'll be successful. And project professionals listening to this will know that we need a support system to help us capture the information to be able to deliver. But it's only when we feel safe and connected to a group of people who will motivate and inspire us to be the best of us that we actually get the job done. You know, the PMI, one last thing, the PMI said in 2019 in the Pulse of the Profession, in the opening gambit, they said, you know, kind of the project management profession just isn't changing enough. Not enough people care. And it's so true. And I think we're seeing generationally now a bunch of people who are prepared to reject that and go, we need something different.
But can you teach some of that stuff there? So what you're saying, that the changes that we do need, and I think we've all survived toxic cultures and toxic projects. Can you actually teach that, or do you just need to experience it?
You can totally teach it. But what we need is there's two elements to that from an individual and organization perspective. Any project person, anybody involved in any kind of projects right now, you need to know that you have permission to create something that addresses some of the things that are broken in your organization. So these are subcultures. A project is a subculture within the larger organization culture. If you're a project manager, you have permission to create an awesome subculture, right, that delivers your project. And this is where, in a way, I created my own reputation. I don't want to take full credit, because actually I was part of a team. And as a project manager, it was my responsibility to help the team to build that culture. But I think too many people are like, oh, we have to conform to cultural norms. No, you don't. You can create your, like, if you're answering emails all day, if you're in meetings all day, you don't have to do that in your own project. You can create something that goes against that. So that's the first thing, is making sure the project people know that they've got permission to do it. Organizations, you can teach it, but they don't invest in it. And I know that, Martin, because my work, I do experience programs, right? And so this is where I teach people actual practical things that they can do differently. Courageous conversations, how to define a vision, how to set expectations really well, how to build a high performing, team. But organizations don't invest in that. What they invest in is sending everyone on a method course, right? Which, whilst it has its merits, doesn't fundamentally change the way stuff gets done. And 95% of my business is in helping teams build great cultures, not projects create different experiences.
Why do you think they send them on these methodology training courses rather than the other side of the coin? Because it makes sense, right? If you discuss it with any decision maker at any organization, they won't be able to pick holes in what you're saying. But yet it comes back to this, you sort of, you know, ones and zeros, right? And here's a methodology. We'll pay this organization that's got a really good brand name. And so, yes, obviously it's worth the tens of thousands of pounds we're spending on this training course per individual. Yet there might be someone out there, like the Colin D. Ellis's, like the Joe Lucas's out there that we've had in the podcast, that actually when you peel back the layers, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But what is stopping organizations? Is it just easier to say, well, hey, look, we've got one of the big four in, and they said X, and we paid 100K, and so it must be true, versus we got some person in? Well, is that part of the challenge?
There's two issues that, as I say, Dale, is firstly, it's a lack of knowledge, and secondly, it's impatience. So a lack of knowledge of what project management really, really is. Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, what they'll do is they'll read a paper on, like, you know, and one of the things I joke about all the time is, before the world was going hybrid, we were going agile. It was seen as the latest silver bullet. And the lack of knowledge, for those of you who got any knowledge of Agile, you know that the Agile movement was born in 2001, the Snowbird Resort in Utah. And it was about software developers who didn't feel trusted to develop good product to their customer. And the Agile movement centered around culture, right? And what we did in the project management world is we packaged it up as a new method, and it became Scrum. Now, not that Scrum is wrong, not that DSDM is wrong, not, none of these things are wrong, but they're just one small part of it. And actually, Agile is a mindset, mm-hmm. right? It's around flexibility. It's about continual evolution and iteration. But what leaders did is they saw that, or they were recommended that, or they heard that Spotify and the Netflix models were always copied, and they tried to copy. You can't copy culture, because agile is culture. And then it didn't work. And they were like, oh, we thought this would work. Oh, it didn't work. And there are some organizations who made it work because they actually evolved and grew their culture. So firstly, it's a lack of knowledge. Secondly, it's impatience. And what they want is a silver bullet to fix projects. And interestingly, Martin and I were talking about football just before we came on the podcast. And, you know, I was talking about the fact that my football team has got a new manager. And I talked about the fact that for managers to be successful over time, they need to be given the time to develop a culture, right? And senior leaders don't give PMO managers, they don't give heads of projects the time to build a culture of delivery, because they have this Nike approach, just do it, just do it, just do it, just do it. And that's not the way projects work. You build a plan, build a team, build a plan, deliver the project, regardless of the method that we use. So there's an impatience, but then what that leads to then is failure. And that leads to more impatience, more failure, more impatience, more failure. And I guess the other thing that falls off the back of that is they try and do too many projects in 1 year, and then they wonder because they're so impatient about how they get delivered, how they get this continual failure. And, you know, I wrote about this, is there's no profession like project management that captures lessons learned and then continues to make the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, Einstein would have had a feast with
Brian. Oh, yeah, really.
But interestingly, I love listening to you there, because you touch a lot on culture, which is obvious because of where you're at in what you do. And I've asked this question to some other guests, and we may have asked this to you when you were on originally, but I'd love to ask you again if I did. Is it culture that drives behaviors, or is it behavior that drives culture?
Yeah, it's kind of that whole, what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah.
Well, it was the egg, obviously, but what laid it? It was a chicken, you idiot. culture is a sum of everyone's attitudes, beliefs, behaviors, traditions, skills. So for me, it's behavior that contributes to culture.
Okay.
In order to create great culture, what you need is people who bring the right attitude to their work on a daily basis, and they believe things are possible. And for any of you who've read the great book Mindset by Carol Dweck, you know, she really breaks it down. And our mindsets are made up of a number of different attitudes. And it only takes one broken attitude to affect your mindset. And that attitude can be towards the weather, especially here in England, it's pouring down outside. It can be towards the weather. It can be towards your job, your teammate, your sports team. You know, I've talked about in the past that my Monday morning used to be affected by the fact that Everton used to lose. Right. And that would affect my mindset towards my job.
And the accent gets thicker when you say it, right?
It does, like, yeah, but Everton lose. It's like desperate, mate, But for me, if you take the time to build a culture at the start, so this is where you bring everybody together, you know, and one of the last thing that I did before I left Australia to come to Europe was I worked with a bank, huge program of work, but they want to do it in the right way. And they said, oh, we've kind of started, but we recognize that we want to build a team culture. And even though we've just started, we want to do this upfront. We wanted it first. And they brought me in to facilitate a session, which I do, where you actually build and define the culture with everybody in the room, it's consultants, the staff from the two banks, and take the time to talk about what are the behaviors that we expect of each other, what's our vision for this project or this program of work, what are some principles of collaboration, what tools will we use, how will we communicate, mm-hmm. when a camera's on, when a camera's off, when will we phone each other, when's it appropriate to send an email, when's it appropriate to send a message on Teams. All of these things contribute to the way that you feel, and they affect your behavior. So if you get up in the morning and you open your email and there's like 1,000 emails in there, it immediately affects your mindset. Whereas if you wake up in the morning, you've got 5 emails because you've made some agreements with each other about what you'll communicate, when you'll communicate it, and how you're going to work together to achieve the objectives, it all of a sudden it changes the dynamic of delivery. And we start to believe that anything is possible. So as soon as we hit a roadblock, we're like, we know we can do this because we've made these agreements with each other. And the best projects ever are results of the people that lead them and the environments they create for great people to do great work. And whilst the method is important in the sense that it gives us a support structure so that we can channel our efforts and energy so we know exactly how we're going to do this, projects are still about people.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say quite a few of our listeners would have sat through some of those meetings, particularly the ones who have worked on major projects. We certainly both have in our previous times. When you go back to the company, say in 6 months, just be, you know, maybe feedback, has it really worked? What's the general sense? Has it, when you go back, say 6 months later, are they still holding themselves to account, generally speaking, or are the wheels starting to fall off in your experience?
Yeah, so what I want to tell you, Martin, is everything that I work on is massively successful, 100% success rate, and I get repeat work all over the world. It's not true because, you know, and the organizations where it does work is where they build in accountability where I come back because they're like, oh, my God, it's going to come back.
But you've enabled them to do that, haven't you?
Yeah, I've enabled them to do that. So as part at the end of the 2 days, we create or I create accountability partners. These are people, not necessarily people that you're working with, but especially if you're not working together, where you meet every month and talk about what you're doing, how you're challenging yourself. Are you making sure you're demonstrating the behaviors? Are you upholding the principles of the way that you work? And so where they know I'm coming back, they're like, we've got to do it because it's going to hold us to accountable, hold us to account. Some organizations are hugely successful because they're like, we're going to take this and we're going to do it. But some just like, that was a great 2 days. It was amazing, right? And people will talk about the 2 days and then by the next month, they've gone back to the old ways of doing things because behavior change is hard and that's why accountability is required. And you know, this is where I often say a project management office can help with accountability. They just need to lose the focus on process and put it more on people and culture. And of course, Dale, you're right. Of course I could say that. That's my area of expertise. But I was in the project business for 15 years, and what made us successful was we made the agreements to each other. We did some randomly different stuff. We wouldn't let anybody do anything that was countercultural, and we would support things that were a little bit maverick and a little bit out there, provided that they contributed to the quality of the outcomes. But that accountability is key.
It's an interesting one as well, because you need that senior leadership sponsorship as well as the desire to want to change. And as Martin says, you know, we've all been in these workshops and they're fantastic, and then the workshop ends and that's where it stops. And it's a particularly tough nut to crack. And I like your analogy between the oil tanker and the wind farm, and, you know, sort of elaborating on that. You said it's kind of almost like if you're an observer, you're kind of like, I don't want the oil tank. I want more wind farm. I want more of that. But in that scenario, I guess there's a demand. In organizations, we don't typically select or demand who our leaders are. And so then does it become an extremely important appointment for whether it's a board or whether it's the CEO or the MD of a company to appoint project managers, project leaders, project directors, whatever the case may be, in a project that actually exhibit the right behaviors and right leadership qualities to create the right culture? Because thinking back to our dear friend Marco Presendo, who's been on plenty of times, he mentioned it was a Cotter's rule or something like that, where, you know, typically what happens is the CEO hires a board, you know, of people that are just slightly less competent than him because he doesn't want to feel threatened. And then the next CEO, because it comes from that pool, is less competent. They do the same. And eventually you just end up with incompetent people.
Yeah, talking about politics in the UK. Yeah.
So I'm thinking, you know, we've heard before the fish rots from the top. And as much as, you know, we can all in organizations or on projects go, I want the wind farm, how do we actually make that happen in organizations? Because I feel like it's a tough nut to crack. If you find the right person that's in the right position in the right organization, you'll see definite change. But how do we stop having an amazing resource like a Colin DLS for 2 days in a workshop and it ending there versus actually let's take what you've set up there and really embed that into an organization.
So my project experience programs, the first half day is always with senior leaders. And I always insist on speaking to senior leaders before I do the 2 days with project managers. And the education process there is just why project management's important and why it's their job to role model the behaviors they expect of everybody and why they have to be involved in projects, in planning, all of these things that they're not prepared for, because they see project management as another hat. And I was like, it's not another hat, it's like another set of clothes, and they pinch in uncomfortable places. They really, really do. And they need to understand that in order to do projects well, they have to be committed. Now, most organizations, what they will do is they'll promote people into senior management positions based on length of tenure or technical expertise. It's that whole PETA principle, right? You're promoted to your level of incompetence.
Yeah, I love that.
Which is great, which I absolutely love. And that's my experience. And so, you know, and I've gone on record in the past saying I kind of feel for senior managers sometimes. Yeah, there are very few leaders, but I feel for senior managers because they're told that they're sponsoring projects and they have no idea what it means. There was one organization that I worked for, they were doing it wasn't that big, it was like a $2 million project. And the CFO was sponsoring it. He's like, oh, I've heard all about you, bring you in, blah, 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 blah. He's like, right, so I'll come in and I'll do an opening speech at the head of the 2 days because I'm helping them define the culture for this big project. He's like, then I'll leave you to it. I'm like, no. He's like, well, I was like, no, that's not the way it works. He was like, oh, what do you mean? I was like, you'll do the opening, the 2 days, and you'll say how important it is, and then you'll stay for the 2 days because you're part of the team. He was like, oh, I'm not sure I've got the time. I'm like, okay, cool. He's like, okay, great. I was like, sorry, when I said cool, I mean cool, let's not do it.
Mm.
I was like, because you have to realize that you're the fulcrum of the project. Everything revolves around you. You seem to be thinking that everything revolves around the project manager. It does not. I was like, that's the important partnership that needs to exist, but you're accountable, which means everything centers around you. So when I do my programs and speak to leaders, like, it's your project. If it goes wrong, you're on the hook. It's your reputation that will be damaged. It's your job to make sure that the project manager is doing their job. Your job to make sure that they plan it well, they deliver to it, that they manage the risk. It's your job to make sure that you don't add scope that's unnecessary, that stretches the timelines of the project and makes it go over. It's your job. And they're like, you just see like wide-eyed going, I didn't sign up for this. So how do I get out of it?
Can I jump in there?
Yeah.
So interestingly, I had a conversation recently and we're touching on Switzerland and, you know, they have their cantons.
Mm.
Right, so there's no government structure as such. Everyone votes on everything all the time. And I said, well, can we take that and apply that to projects? And the challenge back was, well, you know, then you don't, who's responsible for health and safety? Who's responsible for this? Who's responsible for that? And I said, well, isn't that the problem today? Because if you have someone responsible for health and safety, I'm not. But if we were all responsible for it, then perhaps there's something to be had. So maybe we all vote for the ways in which we work rather than someone telling us, because it's their idea, we're not bought into it, we're not accountable,
yeah,
or maybe not responsible, either way you look at it. And so is there perhaps an idea to go, actually the structures we've got in place today for projects is actually the problem with the way we deliver projects? Because if it's the project manager where the buck stops and he or she is accountable for that, well, okay, if I don't, you know, put up 10 layers of bricks today because the project plan says so, it's not on me, it's on the project manager. If I don't write 10,000 lines of code today for that functionality, it's not on me, it's the project manager, you know. But perhaps if there's the shared accountability, aka Switzerland, maybe things which, I don't know, there's just thoughts that come to my head.
Well, I what we want is shared responsibility. And so I would agree with that to a point. The book's got to stop somewhere. Someone's got to make the decision. Someone ultimately has got to say, I've heard all of the evidence and we're going to go this way. I'm not a fan of shared accountability, particularly in projects. But you have to remember that project management profession was born out of construction, technology. Typically, they were command and control kind of environments.
Yes.
And so I'm a big believer in shared responsibility. And the only way you can get to a shared responsibility model is where you agree the culture that you're going to work to. And then, Dale, it's about bringing the right people in at the right time to have the right discussion, to make the right decision in order for you to get the right outcome. And too many projects, sometimes they strive for this, and too many team cultures, to be honest, strive for this harmonious environment where everybody gets a say. And you know if you're working in one of those because everyone gets copied in every email, right? And if everyone's getting copied in every email, everyone gets invited to every meeting, you're going to have a big, big problem. Because we can't tell someone that, Dale, this is not for you. Because we're worried about how it might hurt your feelings. Mm-hmm. So I think what we want to strive towards is create a culture where people feel able to step in and take responsibility, even if it's not their job, because that's what the team demands. But because we don't build teams right now, it's everyone for themselves. So project managers still draw project hierarchies, you know, and they put them in project plans. You know, for anyone who's ever read Stanley McChrystal's book, Team of Teams, that's not the way that teams work. And everyone's worked in a team. You know, you've got all of these different dynamics and they're all pulling in different ways and all interacting. And so they don't work in the kind of, you know, kind of hierarchical structural way. So we need to think about it differently. We need to draw it differently. But ultimately, we need to make people feel differently. And the only way that we can do that is by agreeing how we're going to do that, by agreeing what that sense of belonging looks like, to define it so people can hold each other to it and step up when required.
Yeah, so, and I love the fact that we can have a good debate about this as well. And what springs to mind as you talk there is Dave Snowden's idea that perhaps there shouldn't be a single project manager. It should be a project management crew, perhaps, with certain individuals responsible for certain things. And Dave being Welsh, you know, loves his rugby. Me being South African, love the rugby analogy as well. And if you look at rugby teams, you have leaders in certain roles. There is obviously the captain, but you have the leader of the forwards, leader of the backs, leader of defense, leader of attack, et cetera, et cetera, leader of the line arts, yada, yada. For those of you that don't.
You only had 9 whiskeys.
This is the second bottle. But for those of you that don't know rugby union, go ahead and Google it. But yeah, so perhaps maybe that's where we land, as a bit of a hybrid to both ways of thinking, the traditional hierarchy versus perhaps a Switzerland, where you get, and maybe we are there in a certain sense, but we haven't recognized that we're there. But if you think about it, and New Zealand's famous for having the culture of the New Zealand rugby team, don't be a dick, right?
Yeah.
That's their single slogan for their culture.
Yeah.
Right? If you're a dick, you're out.
Yeah.
And if Val was here, you'd chime in with that. He loves that type of saying as well.
And is he not here because he's a dick?
Yeah.
I'm only joking about.
Yeah. But Val, Colin did say that he would catch up with you in person, but he's flown all the way to the UK to catch up with Martin and me first. So yeah.
Val never offered whiskey. That was the problem.
Exactly.
Absolutely can. But it's a good point you make about sports teams. Now you think about, you know, and it's a tired analogy and it's often a masculine analogy. So I'm not going to go into it too much, but most people will see this in their organizations. Is we think leadership is associated with a position, a hierarchical position. It's not. Anybody at any age, at any time, has the opportunity to lead. We need to create these safe workspaces where people feel that they can lead. You know, and the example that I give is Greta Thunberg is a world leader. She's like 19. She's a world leader because she had the courage to stand up and say, this is my viewpoint, and I'm going to create something that's so easy to follow that people will do so. What we don't want is people. We don't want multiple leaders all at the same time because no work will get done. What we want to do is create an environment, much like we see in sports, where the ball is over there, I'm going to lead. The ball is coming this way, I'm going to lead. The ball is over there, I'm going to lead, or the puck, or whatever it might be. All the best sports teams, they have different leaders in different positions. Now, that's not to say that the decisions that they make when the ball gets there are always right. But they always learn from those mistakes, which makes them better leaders. You know, and one of the things I often talk about is, you know, I was a permanent employee for 30 years. And in that time, I worked for 6 leaders. It's not enough, because people get promoted to these management positions, these senior management positions, and then they go on leadership programs, but they never make the choice to lead. And leadership is a choice to make a positive difference to people's lives every single day. And you can do that whether you're a data analyst or a project manager. You can do that whether you're a business analyst or a project director. anybody can choose to leave, but we still need to create the environment where people feel safe enough to stand up and go, I'll take that. Here's what I believe. And they won't get shot down by someone who said, well, you're just a business analyst. What do you know? And that happens still in these hierarchical structures. And it stops people from speaking up. And then innovation stymies or solution stymies. And then we wonder why the project's gone.
You know, sorry, Martin. You know, when you said that earlier, I sort of just counted in my head my career. And I could count three leaders only.
Yeah,
I work with plenty of managers.
Yeah.
But three that I can count as real leaders. And that's scary if you think about it.
Yeah, most leadership teams there are self-appointed. They'll say we're the leadership team. I worked with one once. I was like, yeah, the staff will decide that. I was like, honestly, this is a leadership team of seven people. I was like, one of you will be a leader. And the rest of you will think that leader's a maverick.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Have you ever been asked to go into organizations where we kind of mentioned being a football team earlier, where the culture has really changed over the last 5 or 6 years due to having a great coach, but they're not really getting the results? And you know, it's kind of coming to a head now where the culture is fantastic, they're not really getting the results, and that something's going to have to stop quite soon because they're not quite getting it. Have you ever had to deal with that scenario before, or is it always get the culture right first? And
yeah, so I work with all different kinds of cultures, and you know, I can think of one project and program that I worked with, Martin, where they just weren't able to stick to the schedule. And so they did a reset. And I did this kind of culture reset program where I just go in and help people to kind of reestablish the connection with each other, talk about the vision of the project, talk about why they're not being able to do what they did, and almost just get them to be honest with each other about why they're not getting where they need to in order to achieve the results. I think there are some teams and organizations that I work with where they kind of look at the culture and they say it's good to a point.
Yeah.
And good to a point means that what's happened is it started off as vibrant, as, oh, this is where we need to be. We've made these agreements to each other, and everyone feels that sense of togetherness, that sense of belonging, which is awesome. But then it becomes pleasant. Mm-hmm. It becomes very nice, and everyone's like, oh, it's so good to be this. But you're not achieving the results that you actually set out to achieve because it's just all become a bit too nice, and it's all become a bit too harmonious. And so my role is to go in there and, you know, I remember one CEO said to me, he's like, I want you to give us a bit of a rock up. And I said, well, I'll give you a bit of a rock up, but in a high EQ way, high emotional intelligence way, where I'm just going to remind you of the agreements that you made to each other, the talent that you have. It will never eradicate mistakes. Humans make mistakes. And sometimes with sports teams, it's one mistake that costs them the game, particularly in the internationals. Mm-hmm. But what you always want to see is progression, Martin. And it doesn't matter whether you're a sports team or an IT team or a construction team. You want to see progression. You want to see that you learned and you did it differently. And there always has to be that sense of optimism, that sense of growth mindset. And if you have that, then you're prepared to continue to back the leader and the manager to go, they're on the right track. But when that sense of optimism isn't there, the sports analogy is they've lost the dressing room. And they've lost the dressing room, all of a sudden is we got to the point where we don't believe in what they're doing anymore. We can't allow a toxic person to influence that, you know, and often there's this one person, you know, there's one bad apple that's spoiling the fruit bowl, you know. And there was a story in the paper this week about a member of the English national team, the women's national team, who'd been dropped because of our attitude. Yeah, damn right too, because that person's infecting everybody else. I work with a range of teams, and sometimes people just need a gentle reminder. But as long as you see progression, I think people are generally like, okay, we can do this. And it's about making sure that we all perform on the day in order to achieve it.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I like your sort of reset. And I think that takes a lot for a team, especially one that perhaps has been doing something the same way for a long time. And it's almost that self-awareness, that collective self-awareness to say, where we're at isn't where we should be. But then you do get the groupthink, right? Well, surely we all think the same, so it must be right. And it's not our fault that the results aren't coming. And I think it's really difficult to break that mold. Well, certainly from my perspective, you probably got the techniques without giving away all your trade secrets.
If suddenly this podcast is going to cost you money.
Well, we better get more sponsors. So for me, it's going, how do you infiltrate? How do you, I mean, and this is the thing, without someone within the organization recognizing it and going, we need a Colin to come in and help us. Maybe someone listening to this podcast is going, you know what? What you said there resonates with me. How do you, as an individual within that team or organization, start making a change if you're not in a position of influence or authority?
Yeah, remembering that leadership is a choice and that anybody can do it, and it doesn't, you don't necessarily have to be in a position of, but I think authority is required when you need to spend money. Authority is required when you need to sign a contract or something like that, but you don't need permission to build a really awesome team. I think some tips and all the advice that I give, you know, largely these are all things that I've either done myself or my clients have done and they've been successful. Is every, you know, every project you, if you feel you're struggling right now, is you bring your team together, just do a kind of a round table where you share something fun about each other. You know, one of my favorite icebreaker at the minute, which I'm happy to give away. My favorite icebreaker at the minute is getting people on tables to find the thing that they have in common, right? So let's say it's a team of, let's say it's 20 people. I would, you know, four groups of five groups of four, and everyone at the table spend 15 minutes finding all the things you have in common. Now, the classic fixed mindset is we've got nothing in common. And then you're like, oh, we're all right-handed. Oh, we've all had COVID. Oh, we're all from the UK. And it starts like that. Oh, all our parents do. You know, and they're the things that build human connection. And once you've got that, you've got a sense of levity where all of a sudden things don't feel quite so serious, right? So if you're going to do a reset and you're going to take a day to do it, do something like that to begin with. And then talk about what's all the stuff that you're great at. As a project, what's great? Because, you know, and it's one of the things I'm always careful to do every time I run a program or every time I run a session, is I want you to focus on the positives first, because so much stuff you do is great. And then what's the opportunities for improvement? Not what's broken. What's the opportunities for improvement? And then focus on making agreements to each other to address the opportunities for improvement whilst retaining all the stuff that's good. Right. And it really is as simple as that. But what happens too often, Dale, is the opportunities for improvement. Let's just say one of the opportunities for improvement is we need to be more honest. Right. So the agreements that they'll make to each other are things like speak up when we disagree. Right. Which is good.
Mm-hmm.
But is it practical? No, it's just a statement.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? So the agreement that you make is, and we used to do this as a team, we would have what we call an honesty half hour. So we would implement on it. So the action was hold an honesty half hour session every week. And we would meet once a week for half an hour and just be honest with each other about something that's good or an opportunity for improvement. It was always an opportunity for improvement. They were so confronting. First time we did, like, I thought it was a great idea. I was like, yeah, we're going to do this. And the first one was so awkward. The second one was less awkward. By the third and the fourth one, we were just really in the mood. And then what this magical thing's happened is it just starts happening naturally. Because I think honesty is crucially important if we're to work together effectively to achieve the outcomes. So it's little things like that that you don't need permission for.
Mm.
It's little thing, that, you know, the other really, really simple one is most people misuse technology, right? So email is a classic example. Email is an asynchronous tool. So I send Dale an email. It's up to him to decide when he's going to reply to it.
Yeah, but you've told me because you've sent it to me, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I've received it. And I'm in the subject's all caps. And I've said urgent. That's a classic mistake that people make. They send an email and the title's like urgent. It's like, if it's urgent, you phone. Like, seriously, if it's urgent, you phone. But you can make these agreements. You know, we used to make these agreements. We said, no, we won't email. We used to say that. We will not email each other. We won't copy people in. Like, we said, no blind. I remember one project, we said, no blind copy ever. Because sneaky. We don't do that stuff. We don't go behind people's backs. But like, you know, Microsoft Teams, you can agree what goes in what channel. When is it appropriate to share something? When is it appropriate to not? Do you have specific times when you do that? How do you make sure, what's the difference between synchronous and asynchronous? When do I expect Martin to reply instantly as opposed to when do I give him time? These are all things you don't need permission for. But when you do them really well, people are like, I don't know what you're doing, but it sounds great. Can we copy it?
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because as you talk there and what's going through my head is sort of that introspective, like, you know, can you identify, are you aware of, you know, we've spoken about already. And then what jumped into my head was Val recently posted, yeah, don't tell him I told you, it was a good thing. He recently posted on LinkedIn a little clip from a TED talk, and a surgeon gave it. And he was saying how he's been a surgeon, you know, for 20, 30 odd years and whatever the case may be. And he decided, well, you know, he's top of his game, but he wants someone to coach him. Yeah. And I don't know, I can't remember what triggered him, but he got somebody in to come and just observe him performing an operation, and just silently. And he was top of his game. And he and the person that went and observed him had all of his notes, like, you're almost too high, you did this, you did that. And he improved his game even further. And that's that growth mindset that you're talking about. And I just wonder how many leaders are courageous enough to say, I might have been in this leadership, inverted commas, role for 10, 15 odd years, but there's still more I can do to improve. Because often you find that it's a strange one, isn't it? You find yourself in this organization, and one of the first things you do naturally as a human being, you try and figure out how it works, what are the dynamics, who's the person that calls the shots, who's actually the real leader, right? How does this work? Okay, whose buttons can I push in certain ways? That's just naturally what we do. We might not do it methodically, but we do that subconsciously, because we create connections that way. And that's part of culture probably as well. And I don't really know where I'm going with this, but I think where I'm heading with it is that if you recognize certain things within yourself, and as you're going about your journey identifying it, and even though you might be in the same team for 5 odd years, perhaps there's some things that you know that you think you can change. And I just wonder, how do we allow ourselves to be more courageous? Because courage is quite an interesting thing. It's a deep sort of personal feeling, right? You could use a typical example, I guess, a roller coaster. Are you courageous enough to get on it, or bloody hell, it's too fast, or it's too high? And so how do you invoke that? You might have all the ideas, you might see things. How do you create, can you create courage?
Well, you can. There's two elements to courage. There's professional, personal courage and professional courage. Uh-huh. So personal courage is exactly as you said, is can I get on this roller coaster and make myself feel uncomfortable? But the same is true also in work, and professional courage is there's some things that you're not good at. And one of the things, you know, often is people aren't good at having courageous conversations with other people, and they need a structure, they need to follow a structure. One of the things that, for me, one of the things that's missing right now in the world is the ability to set expectations really well. And it's kind of undermining hybrid work, because managers just don't go out to set expectations. Because managers, you know, some people get to a senior management position, it's almost like the end of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where Ferris goes, I did it, you know? If you haven't seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, then, you know, but they I did it. And that's not the way that you kind of world, like, you can say, I did it when you retire. I did it because I left a legacy where I made a positive difference to people's lives. And I challenged myself to be continually better. And personal evolution and, you know, kind of constant courage is exhausting. It's emotionally draining. Mm. You know, and someone said to me once, they're like, oh, what's the best advice you can give me? He said, I want to be more courageous. What's the best advice you can give me? I said, put yourself to bed at a reasonable time every morning. And he's like, what? I was like, put yourself to bed. He's like, what? He's like, but what do you mean? I was like, because when you're not tired, you're more rational and you're more likely to be able to step outside your comfort zone and see the value in it. When you're tired, you will avoid it like the plague, right? Which is why we always say the best time to do anything courageous is first thing in the morning. when you're completely on top. The best time to have a courageous conversation is always now.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what time it is, it's always right now. And in order to do that, if it's 4 o'clock, you've got to not be tired, right? Which means taking regular breaks during the day, make sure you're refreshing your brain, making sure there's as little time as possible to spend on the device. But courage is something that we can all learn to leverage when we recognize that that's where growth lives. So let's say you're a salesperson. Let's say you're someone who's stepping into sales, but you don't know how to sell. You learn the process for selling, and then you do it. Public speaking, right? So as someone who never used to be a public speaker ever, and then all of a sudden is doing the circuit all over the place. And someone said to me, well, what did you do? I said, I went on a public speaking course to learn a process. So I had that. This is the process for public speaking. And I understood what was special in inverted commas around the way that I could do things. So I stood out and then I did it. I didn't overthink it. I did it. And then a couple of mistakes I made, I learned and I wrote those things down. And then I did it again. By the third time, I'm starting to feel more confident about my ability to public speak. Now, my challenge, Dale, as a high extrovert is analyzing data. So I got someone to teach me how to analyze data, right? Which sounds crazy, but I didn't know. Like when I was a project director, when I was a senior manager, I had financial analysts that worked for me. So I didn't have to worry about that stuff. And so I learned how to analyze data. And now I create the environment where I can be courageous when I analyze data and actually read what's actually written there rather than what I want to read in it. So personal courage, yes, it's about you seeing the benefit of doing something that adds to your quality of life, throwing yourself out of a plane, doing a bungee jump, killing a spider. No, don't kill anything. You know, capturing a spider and releasing it outside. Unless it's a redback spider in Australia, in this case, just kill it because it'll kill you first. And then professional courage is what's the skill you need to learn in order to better do your job. And then do it once, do it twice, do it three times, it starts feeling more natural.
Well, some amazing tips there. And I love the ambient noise we have in the background.
Yeah, that was the integrity police. They know I'm here. They're like, get him.
Oh, he's killing a spider. Like, yeah, we're there.
He's killing spiders. Quick, get in there.
Well, it's great because we spoke about rhubarb a few episodes ago as well with Val. So we went through that as well. But talking about courage, Machine Gun Martin, do you have any provocative or Machine Gun Martin type questions for Colin?
Swinging on the chair trying to get out now. You mentioned something earlier about EI or EQ, emotional intelligence. Mm. It's one of the buzzwords that is banded around quite a lot now in the last generation, let's say. Is it something you can improve? Do you just have it or not?
Some people have it more than others.
But you can't just go on a leadership course, can you? If you've got low EI, are you always going to have it?
No, is the answer. People can always improve their circumstances. One of my favorite quotes is by this playwright, George Bernard Shaw, who said that the people who get on in this life are people who seek out the circumstances they need to do so. And if they don't, they create the circumstances. Right, which I love. And so that's been a key driving force for me, particularly when I started my own business, like, right, how do I seek out those circumstances? Self-aware individuals are the building blocks of great teams. And yet, on average, we're self-aware about 17% of the day, right? So this is our challenge, is how do we be emotionally aware? How do we be aware of how we feel such that it informs our actions? And there's some great work, you know, Daniel Goleman wrote a book on emotional intelligence. If you haven't read the book, he called it emotional intelligence. Creativity is not this thing. And research definitely is. And he lent on the work of Peter Salovey and people like this who really defined what it meant to be emotionally intelligent. And the thing is we downplayed the role of emotional intelligence in our workplaces for far too long. We know that when we're happiest is that we're able to bring our best self to work and we're surrounded by people who want the best for us. Right. You can, I don't believe, you know, there are some certification courses for emotional intelligence. And frankly, there's rubbish, right?
The certification for everything.
Everything. And just because you've got a certificate doesn't mean you are that thing or you know that thing. It just means you're good at passing a test. However, what the certification process does will teach you the skills, but it's up to you to do it. And this is where accountability is important, Martin. So anybody in any job, in any country around the world has got the capacity to be emotionally intelligent. Different people face different circumstances at different times. One of the things that really bugs me, Martin, is I went to a speech just before I started working for myself, and this guy said, if you're working in a team and you don't like it, you've got two choices: stay and change it from the inside or leave, right? And at that time, I'd been working in a highly toxic culture where it was impossible for me to change it from the inside. Me and my team could create our own little pocket of awesome, which we did, but it's impossible for me to change the CEO. I was that far removed. And I couldn't leave because we didn't have any money. We had two young kids. And I'm like, it's real. Life is not that black and white. And so often, you know, I'll say things like, oh, what we need to do is create an environment where people can be the best version of themselves. But everyone's got so many different things going on at any one time that it's impossible to know how to do that. But when we're in a team where we recognize the importance of being emotionally intelligent, even if I'm not being myself, Martin will say to me, hey, Colin, are you all right? You will never judge me. You won't talk to Dale behind my back. You'll ask me, are you okay? And for me, this is one of the strengths of emotionally intelligent teams, is they're high in empathy. They've still got a determination to get stuff done. No brilliant jerks, right? But they actually look out for each other. They care for each other. They build relationships such that they know how to help each other to be emotionally intelligent. And so when someone loses their temper, they're like, their first response is, Martin, are you okay? Hey, listen, it's out of character for you. I just want to let you know that I'm here when you're ready to talk. But what I've actually said is, what you just did is not cool, right? But I'm here for you to talk. But they send those kind of subtle messages. So emotional intelligence is important. Yes, you can teach it, but it's a personal choice that people make on a day-to-day basis.
Great. I want to know, Martin, have you got any features lined up for Mr. Colin D. Ellis? Because last time, I think, when you first joined us, we didn't have any features. Do you have those? I know
the pressure's on now. Yeah.
We have a pop quiz that we do at the end. We at that stage?
We can certainly have it now, and we can continue a little bit after the pop quiz, but I'd like to get it in because Martin asked some really interesting pop quiz questions.
Let's do this.
And he doesn't have his full plethora of his full list that he usually has in front of him, because we usually do this over Zoom. this is the beauty about being disruptive to this podcast, actually, and not being in Zoom and being in person. And the only thing he's got in front of him is a notebook, and he's feeling a bit out of his comfort zone.
So what people can't see is Martin's written like a million notes, and I'm trying to look over, going, what's he written there?
and as we've always said, this is unscripted, so anything can happen. We've had the ambient noise, the bloopers, so which is great.
You had your spider police.
But yeah, if you wouldn't mind taking Colin through his paces.
Okay. So we've got time for a quick session called Fiverr. So five quick fire questions all about yourself. We might need to boy band this one at some point, but
boy band.
Boy band with the man of the cap. Yeah. Right. So if we go question number one, are good leaders born or made?
They're made.
Number two, steak, seafood, or salad?
Seafood.
I'm gonna go for, if you could go back to one moment in your life, what would it be and why?
I was 27. It was my first project management job. I walked in to see my boss. I told him that my team of developers and infrastructure engineers were idiots because they didn't want to do any of the social activity that I'd planned. And he listened to me and told me that I was the idiot for assuming that everybody was like me and I should listen to them more. Changed my life. Totally changed my professional life.
Oh, amazing. I'll ask you question four, I guess, then Martin can end with number five. Maybe there's a sixth or seventh or eighth or tenth as well. Okay, let's go for, I'm just trying to think back on all the juicy ones we've asked before. We're talking about culture. What are the three must-have behaviors you look for in successful project teams?
So courage is one, because there's a continual requirement for people to step outside their comfort zone. Even when we're in our comfort zone delivering, there's still that thing that comes up. Discipline is the second one. I think it's prevalent in all workplace cultures, is they never make excuses. They get stuff done. And empathy for me is the third, is that willingness to create connections with other human beings, to see things from their standpoint, such that we never just take our own selfish view on the world and we're prepared to consider all viewpoints.
Wow. Someone listening to this might actually say that's scripted, but it's not. That's amazing, honestly.
What would be your advice to a fresh-faced project manager? Project management graduate?
Don't read too much about what's gone before. We don't have a great track record of delivery, oh, the irony, but we really, really don't. Business depends on you. Business depends on projects for ongoing viability, to fix things that are broken, to exploit new opportunities. What you need to do is to train yourself up in a bunch of techniques to help you plan and deliver project, but never forget that the greatest gains will come from you building a team of connected human beings who see the value in each other's work and are prepared to work together to get the job done. So don't concentrate too much on the past, create your own plan for the future, and build something that people will talk about 5 years and go, that was one of the best things I ever did.
Wow. Well, yeah, mic drop. I almost feel like we should end the pod there, but I won't just yet.
I built up big, you know.
Yeah, you certainly,
that was my closing bit.
You certainly did. You certainly did. But we won't let you go just yet. Where to next from London? What's on the cards for Mr. Colin Dielis?
So I'm going up to Liverpool. There's a couple of meetings that I've got with people up there. And I'm going to see the family and watch Everton hopefully beat Leicester at home. It's the thing that I miss most, Dale. I must admit, you know, it's a question I get asked a lot in Australia whenever I'm interviewed. And they say, oh, what do you miss most about England? Is it family? I'm like, no, it's going to the match. Because it's a big part of the culture of this country, and I love doing that. Then on to Manchester. I've got a couple of speeches in Manchester. And then I've got a weekend in Copenhagen. I've got a couple of general managers to catch up with there who are interested in some culture work. And then on to Germany to work with Red Bull. And, you know, and I do call out Red Bull because they are... they're a fabulous, fabulous culture, regardless of what you think about energy drinks and all of those kind of things. They're a fabulous culture of people who do so much work to create an environment where their employees kind of feel connected to each other, but also want to do good work. And almost everyone I speak to is like, oh, I'd love to work for Red Bull because of the culture.
Any specific examples of that?
Yeah. Well, so many. So the workspace, for a start, Martin. Many organizations right now are like, how do I get people back to the office? Right. And, you know, I spoke to one organization in Australia. I was like, is this your... I was there speaking to the senior leadership team. They're like, how do we get people back here? I was like, is this your office? They were like, yeah. I was like, well, you can make it less shit. And the CEO was like, what? I was like, it's a bit dull. It's a bit bland. I was like, honestly, if you wanted me to come back here, I'm like, it's going to have to change. The Red Bull really, you know, and I use Red Bull as an example. I use IKEA as an example. I use Lego as an example. Mm-hmm. These are great cultures who think, what's the kind of environment that we can create that people want to come to collaborate, where they want to come and be creative? And so Red Bull do that. They create these awesome environments where you can find a quiet space, you can find a collaborative space, you can find a quiet meeting room if you need to have a one-to-one. They have these social spaces, right? And they really put lots of thought, time, and effort. It's not just this big social, let's throw a Formula One car in there, let's throw Felix Baumgartner's suit over there, let's throw some Lindsey Vonn skis over there. The other thing that they do really well is that they continually evolve their culture. They do things every single month to make sure that they inject new energy, new ideas. You know, and the great cultures do this, Martin, is that it's no accident that big tech companies have great cultures. There's an organization in Australia called Atlassian. They do products such as Jira, Confluence.
Yeah.
Now, I've been very fortunate to be in there. One of my good mates works there. they're doing something almost every week, every month to create this sense of connection. And I've worked with Cisco. I'm speaking at the conference next month. They same thing. They're reconfiguring their offices. They're always thinking. These organizations spend lots of time, lots of money, and they give their employees freedom and responsibility to come together. Now, the argument there is, oh, I work in government. I work for the NHS. Right? I work for the NHS. I can't do that. You can. You just don't have the money. You can't reconfigure your office space, but you can still create your own pocket of awesome. And I worked as a public servant for nearly 9 years with no money. And I did that myself with my teams. Me and my teams did this, or we did this. It wasn't about me. We did these things. And we looked at ways that we could do something. And we shared them. Like, we had a Christmas party. I worked for one government agency where they cancelled all Christmas parties because they didn't have enough money. And we decided we were still going to have a Christmas party. And we decided that we were going to cover the cost ourselves. And we put a notice up on the notice board, say, we're having a Christmas party. If you want to come, we need to know. And I think it was by like the 10th of November, because we had to then book a venue. And we ended up hosting a third of the company at our Christmas party. And everyone put in, it was $55. Everyone put in $55. And all of a sudden we were having a Christmas party. And the leadership team, the head of HR as it was then, said, I hear you're hosting the company Christmas party. It's like, no, we're having a Christmas party for our team that other people are invited to. And people paid. So you can still do this stuff, but we still think that we need permission and we have to fund it ourselves. But that's a great, those kind of cultures, they put time, effort, thought into doing things differently.
Wow.
So that's word two. I felt like I've toured Europe, but I give you that answer. Yeah.
No, you absolutely did. And it's great. And you know, we're truly grateful that you've taken the time out to spend time with us. Because you know, you are well known on the circuit. You have a very, very busy schedule. So honestly, thank you so much. Before we do let you go, any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, the final thought, Dale, I would say is I left more school with as many suspensions as I did qualifications, which was 3. That's a whole other podcast. I think sometimes what we do is we're constrained by our own mindset. We seek inspiration from those who have done these hugely grand things and blah, blah, blah. What I would say is inspiration lives in small stories that everyday people have. Mm-hmm. I like to consider myself as an everyday person. The highest salary I ever earned as a senior director was $150,000, which is about, I don't know, £110,000. So really not that much when you consider I had a 30-year career. And yet there are still people that would work with me and for me again, because I felt they feel like I made a difference to their lives. And what I would say is anybody has the capacity and the capability to be able to do that. You just have to find that little spark of magic that's inside of you that can bring light to other people's lives. And it might be humor, it might be data, it might be structure, it might be process. It might be saying good morning. It might be saying, how are you? It might be saying, what can I do for you? It might be shouting a coffee for someone in the queue behind you, those little sparks every single day. Anybody, anywhere can make a difference of other people's lives. Just don't waste this opportunity that you've got.
Amazing. And if I may just squeeze one last drop out of you, any thoughts or words for Val as he listens back to this?
Well, Val, hopefully you've got FOMO. And if you'd offered me whiskey, this would have happened in Australia way earlier, because I'm literally there 9 months of the year. What I would say to Val, what I would say to people outside the UK is you have the same opportunities in your city as everybody else does. Create a small community dedicated to improving whatever it is that you're passionate about. And Val is one of those people in Melbourne, just like Dale, Martin, you are here. What's the thing that you're passionate about? Bring a group of people together, become united behind that thing, and then role model what you expect of everybody else. And slowly but surely, you'll create this cultural change. You'll light this fire that will be hard to put out.
Wow, amazing, amazing. Look, we're going to leave it there. Colin Dealis, thank you so much. It's been an absolute privilege and honor to have you in the flesh. Good luck with the rest of your journey and your trip and your tour and whatever you got left on the cards. So we thank you for your time. And yeah, we'd love to have you back again. Maybe Val can do an in-person with you when you're back in Melbourne. But yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Dale Martin, thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Fantastic. So folks, there you have it. That's the end of this episode. But remember, before you go, if you do like what you've heard, please do help us pay it forward by sharing a link to this episode on your favorite social media. Once again, a massive, massive thank you to our guest, Mr. Colin Dealis. And thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me and Martin, it's bye for now.
Project Chatter supports and is a member of Zero Construct. Zero Construct is a new working group that wants to lower carbon construction. Not everyone will be aware, but construction contributes to around 12 to 15% of total carbon emissions.
This is a staggering amount, and we need to reduce it. We are a growing community of people that want to help make this change. Everyone is welcome, whether you're an engineer, contractor, or consultant. You just need to want to make a difference.
Our aim is to grow a network of experts so we can all learn from each other and make a positive impact in the places where we work. We'll do this by sharing knowledge and making it accessible in engaging ways.
To join us and find out more, please visit zeroconstruct.com and register as a member. Thank you, and we look forward to speaking with you soon.
For more information, blogs, or to support our charities, visit projectchatterpodcast.com. And if you would like to sponsor the podcast, get in touch via our website.
You can also leave us a voice message via our anchor page and let us know if there's something or someone specific that you would like on the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.